We've been in a series in the Old Testament book of Habakkuk, and we're going to continue in that. Habakkuk chapter 2 is where we're going to be studying this morning. Page 807 on one of those Bibles that you might have grabbed on your way in that we have there for you, page 807, Habakkuk chapter 2. And the last 2 weeks, we've taken a kind of a slow approach to Habakkuk's text, his words, studying a couple verses at a time. This week is going to feel like we're drinking from a hose because we're going to do verses 6 to 20 this morning. And so we're going to take in a big chunk of his text because it's kind of meant the portion of the book that we're going to study today is it's a distinct literary unit from the rest of the book. So we want to take it all in as it was intended, all of it at once. In the unit that we're looking at, verses 6 to 20, it's actually called a woe oracle, and we'll talk about that, what it is. But it's going to feel like we've been going 15 miles an hour, and now we're on the highway. It's going to feel a little bit like we're flying through some of these verses. So buckle up. And tuck in with us here. So Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 6 to 20, again, page 807 in those Bibles that we've provided for you if you need one of those. So Habakkuk has been pushing us to think through how we're going to live our lives under the shadow of the existence of evil and wickedness. That is his context, and he's helping us through his experience think through that and work through that of living life around people or underneath people who just aren't good, but they seem to be benefiting from that. They seem to be doing well in life, even though they're doing things what we would call and consider the wrong way or an evil way. And it seems that God is allowing it for them to benefit from those things, for bad things to happen and have no consequence, while we're trying to live a life honoring him, and doesn't seem to be going as well. We have not just bumps in the road, but we've got like significant detours in our lives, and we're looking at that going, but I tried to do this right. I tried to do this right, and it's not working out for me, but it seems to be working out great for them. And that situation where God allows a difficult life for those who believe in him and want to honor him, and seemingly from our perspective, allowing an easy life for those who don't, that can draw out responses in us, right? And it can affect how we live our life. And last week we saw two responses to that. One of the responses to that reality is to become puffed up, to become bloated in your belief in self and focus on enjoying life now, on the present, and arrogant, restless living, full of concern with your best life now. That's a response to that, to the fact that it doesn't seem to be too much consequence to and seems to benefit people who do things their way. So you can lean into that and bloat yourself up in it, or we can live in faithfulness to our faith in God. Those are the two ways to do this. We can live faithful to our faith in God, or we can lean into our sense of self. And the righteous person, the one who has a right relationship with God, will live faithfully to faith in him, regardless of what they see or what happens around them or what seems like the better way. The righteous person, the one who has a solid, right relationship with God, will live faithfully to faith, regardless, because they believe that the answer is in the end and that God is worth trusting and obeying. Those are the two responses to the realities of life. But God expects faithfulness to faith. That's what he expects. And to this point, God has been talking through this with Habakkuk and Habakkuk's audience because they had complaints about how God was managing that situation, their life and their issues. But now the text is going to shift to Habakkuk witnessing a woe oracle from the lips of the victims of Babylon. And so we're going to start. I'm not going to read all of it in one shot. We're just going to work our way through it, but we're going to kind of, sometimes we're going to work at a pretty decent clip getting through some of these verses. So we're going to start in chapter 2, verse 6. And if in some of your Bibles, you'll notice that the beginning of verse 6, the way that it's actually written there, looks a little bit different from the second half of verse 6 and on, because there's a new quote there. So we're going to take that first section there, verse 6. Will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn, and then he gives that quote. And so this is a distinct shift. When he gets to verse 6, there's a distinct shift in what Habakkuk has experienced in this vision and in this prophecy, because now God is going to communicate his message to Habakkuk through the collective lament cry of victims. And the shift occurs with him saying there in verse 6, "Will not all of them taunt?" This is a shift here. They, when you look at that, verse 6, "Will not all of them taunt?" That them there refers up to verse 5. Remember last week I told you the end of verse 5 is the beginning of that transition. When God answers Habakkuk and says that the enemy, the one opposed, the one on the other side, is he's greedy, greedier than death, because he gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive all the peoples. Those nations, those captive nations, those captive people, that's them. That's what he's talking about in verse 6, the beginning there. That's the them, the gathered nations, the captive peoples. These are those people who are oppressed by the Babylonians in the future. When the Babylonians come in and take over, these are those people. They're oppressed victims. And the rest of this chapter, of chapter 2, is from their perspective. The future oppressed victims of Babylon. And God is using the Babylonians to discipline and judge Judah. And so some of these are the cries of those of the people in Judah as well. And it is a taunt. You see that in verse 6. It's a taunt of ridicule. Ridicule and scorn, or some versions say ridicule and riddle. The NIV says scorn, but these are literary words, all three of them: taunt, ridicule, scorn, whatever version of that you have in your text. They're literary words that refer to a negative proverb, a specific type of literature that follows verses 6 to 20, that negatively assesses and addresses reality. We don't have much of this today. I'll give you an example of when this maybe has happened in your lifetime. But this is a form of poetry that follows, and the shift almost makes it feel like a song. When you read it in Habakkuk's, in Hebrew, it almost feels like a song, but it's a really it's a reality that's evaluated in a proverb, in poetry almost. And it's a discerning summary of reality, like seeing things for what they are. And expressed in this beautiful poetic literature. And specifically, these are woe oracles. They're woe prophecies, and there's five of them in this chapter. So there's five woe prophecies, oracles, and you're going to see that in verse 6. It says it's there, woe. In verse 9, woe. In verse 12, woe. Verse 15, woe. And then again in verse 19, woe. You see it, each of those introduces this new woe declaration that is part of this song or this lament. It's a lament. That word woe is a word that expresses a lament of witnessed judgment or an announcement of certain doom. And like I said, what follows builds into that. We don't have too much of this today. This is not a very familiar form of it for us. The best thing, like I said, in your lifetime, one of them is not even in your lifetime, but I'm likely heard about it, some of you more than others. You remember when the Hindenburg crashed and the radio reporter, as he was watching it, the only thing he could say when he observed it was, "Oh, the humanity." Watch, and that when you hear him say that, you realize this is not just someone who's witnessing something. This is someone who is internalizing and experiencing everything that's about to happen, because he's realizing there are people on that ship, right? And it is crashing, it is burning, it is consuming. This is an all-encompassing, like, I cannot believe what I just saw, right? Now again, like I said, you are aware of that because you saw that video in high school, right? In school, or you heard about that reported. Another one that we could say is when you were watching the events of September 11th, and you didn't see the first plane hit the Twin Towers, but you were watching the news report when the second plane hit, and that stunned response of the reporters, or if you even saw the rare pieces of footage from the ground and the people's expression on the ground when they saw it collapsing, that is this expression of woe. It's a realization of heavy reality. Not just an observation, but a recognition that this is big. There's a lot that just happened. It's not just a building that collapsed. There are lives in that building, and that building didn't just collapse because it was structurally weak. Like, there was so much more going on there, right? That's the best example we have of what an expression of woe is when you read it in the Old Testament, when you read it here. Now, it's a woe oracle, a woe prophecy, and so this is an expression of woe directly from God, with fundamental truth that's connected to it. And so so in that woe statement is little bits and pieces, some of terror, some of sadness, and all these are combined. Terror and sadness, shock, inevitability, like this is unpreventable. I am powerless in watching this. A statement of reality and truth all combine into this one word in the Old Testament, woe. And it's all in there. It's not a statement of that stinks to be you with a smirk, it's a statement of horrible pit in the stomach reality is what a woe statement, a woe oracle is. And there's five of these. And so here are the laments of judgment that the victims of Babylon, the future victims of Babylon, speak. And you'll notice as we read this, Habakkuk is witnessing them say these things to Babylon. They're speaking to Babylon. And it's important to keep in mind, and we're actually going to touch on that in a few minutes. This is first for Babylon. What he's saying, what is being said here, what Habakkuk is recording and witnessing, this is first for Babylon, directly to Habakkuk's complaint and his perplexed faith of, why are you using Babylon? And so these first and foremost are spoken to them. They're God's words, but he is Habakkuk experiencing them, this message through the voices of these victims to drive this judgment home. And so here's what the victims express. We're going to go back to verse 6. So Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 6 to 8. Will not all of them, the victims, taunt him with ridicule and scorn, the enemy, the one that gathers, saying, woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion. How long must this go on? Will not your creditors suddenly arise? Will they not wake up and make you tremble? Then you will become their prey, because you have plundered many nations. The peoples who are left will plunder you, for you have shed human blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. Now remember, these are the victims speaking directly to Babylon, future victims speaking directly to Babylon. So the woe to him here, you're going to see that in verse 6, and you'll see it actually said again. Now you'll notice in verse 6, woe to him, and then in verse 7, will not your, and there's a shift there in pronouns, right? Woe to him, and then there's a direct address. It happens again in verse 9 and 10. Again in verse 15 and 16, there's a general statement and then a direct address to someone. It's both the same people. It's just one is general, one is direct. And that woe to him isn't a general woe to the one who. Sometimes we read that verse 6, woe to the one who piles up stolen goods. If you want to think that a little bit in the back of your mind, there's a good lesson there, right? But this is specifically to Babylon. He's talking specifically to Babylon. And so woe to that guy. Woe to him, right? The one over there, right? So if you've ever been around kids who are getting into trouble and then they realize this is getting out of hand, every once in a while, one of them will say a statement very loud that isn't tattling, but it is tattling, be like, oh man, I can't believe Carter's standing on that, over, right? Something like that, right? They'll say a statement really loud, and they're not tattling, Dad, and then telling me. They're just saying something really loud so everybody notices, like, that guy's over there on the thing, right? And then everybody looks. This is what the victims are doing. They're saying, oh man, wouldn't it be awful if that guy, right? Woe to him who stands on, see him? And they point at him, you're the guy I just talked about. This is what's happening here. And so it's a general statement about the Babylonians, and then they point the finger at the Babylonians and say, now that I've got everybody's attention, it's this guy, right? It's a inadvertent, indirect tattling is what they're doing. So it is said about them, right? And then in some of the oracles, it's said to them. And so the Babylonians, verse 6 to 8, the Babylonians are using their power for profit. And I'm going to summarize these verses and keep moving quickly through each one of them. The Babylonians are using their power for profit. They have built a society based on taking advantage of others' trust without a commitment to integrity, right? Woe to him who piles up stolen goods, makes himself wealthy by extortion. They've used their influence and their power to gain, and they've built their lives on taking advantage of other people's trust, and without any sort of commitment to paying back or having integrity in those dealings. And the victims say that God's message to Babylon is, for this, you, Babylon, you will be victimized. You will be victimized in the same way. This greed and this accumulation at the expense of others, it has not gone unnoticed. It hasn't gone ignored. You will be plundered, they say. You will be plundered. You can count on it. Verse 8, because you have plundered many nations, the peoples who are left will plunder you. Right? And so this isn't something that was ignored. This isn't something that has happened and God doesn't notice. You can count on it. You will be plundered, Babylon. Woe to you, because you use power for profit. And there is a sinking pit in the stomach reality when you hear that, because this is a fact. And it's shocking, and it's terrible to hear. It's woe to you because you use power for profit. Spoken specifically to the Babylonians. They continue into the second one, again describing Babylon, what they've done, but also this lament. Verse 9, woe to him who builds his house by unjust gain, setting his nest on high to escape the clutches of ruin. You have plotted the ruin of many peoples, shaming your own house, forfeiting your own life. The stones of the walls will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. So they continue, woe. The Babylonian success is founded on the oppression of others, cheating, using them. And in order to build what they perceive to be safe and secure, that says that they, by unjust gain, they have escaped the clutches of ruin by building themselves a nest that they perceive so high and so secure, they are out of reach of ruin. That's what they've created their own sense of security and safety at the expense of others. And in doing it, they've plotted the ruin of many other people. They've benefited from that. And so they've sacrificed in order to build what they perceive to be safe and secure for their own lives, for their own families. They've sacrificed the safety and the security of others' lives and other people's families. Forget your family. Forget your life. Forget your security. I'm safe. I'm secure. I've built my nest way up here out of reach. And their safety is built on the backs, the ruin and the pain of others. But God's message through the victims is, you aren't creating long-term security. You think you are, but there are effects that will last far beyond you, right? You have plotted the ruin of many peoples, and there's an unwritten but there, shaming your own house and forfeiting your life. And the stones of the wall will cry out, meaning when you are gone and whatever family takes over your house, you have ruined them. You have left them a legacy that they will not want. Right? You're not creating that long-term security, and that your family will pay for the actions that you've taken. Woe to you because you've sacrificed others and your future and your family's future on the altar of your standard of living. Woe to you, Babylon. So that's that second one, verses 9 to 11. And they continue with this lament, this cry, this song in verse 12 through and 13. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town by injustice. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire, that the nations exhaust themselves for nothing? So again, woe. There's a terrible, shocking, horrible feeling about what we're witnessing here. The Babylonians' economic power and wealth is rooted in cruelty. But the victim's promise, right? Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed, establishes a town, this economic and cultural center is built on bloodshed. But the message, right? The promise for the victims is a message from God. Everything they've gained, in verse 13, everything that they've gained will be burnt and consumed. It's empty, right? It's meaningless. They'll lose all of it at the cost of their integrity. You sacrificed your integrity to build the society for yourselves, and it will all be consumed and gone. It was meaningless what you've done. Woe to you because you've sacrificed others and your future, right? You've sacrificed everything that you have gained to gain for nothing. And now the earmark verse, and when we're going to come back to this in verse 14, is verse 14. So we're going to come back to that. So earmark that, and remember, verse 14 stands out as different in the middle of all of this. We'll come back to verse 14. It's kind of key. But the next woe is in verse 15 to 17. And so you have this building sense of sinking pit in the stomach, terror and inevitability of what's going on with the Babylonians, but what the consequences are going to be for the Babylonians. And now, fair warning, verse 15 to 17, depending on your version or translation, can be a little graphic. And so just bear with it when you read through it. But this is the third one. The Babylonians perverted what is natural. So woe to him who gives drink to his neighbors, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk, so that he can gaze on their naked bodies. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. And now it's your turn. Drink and let your nakedness be exposed. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming around you, and disgrace will cover your glory. The violence you have done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and your destruction of animals will terrify you, for you have shed human blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. So in these verses, there is a lot. There's a lot of accusation here, but they have a common theme, and that common theme there is a perversion of what is natural, right? It's a perversion of what is natural. What God designed has been taken and distorted significantly and used in the wrong way. If you were to read through there again, verses 15 to 17, they perverted enjoyment, they perverted relationships, they perverted sexuality. They perverted nature, and that one maybe didn't jump out to you as much, but in verse 17, when it says the violence you have done to Lebanon, whenever the Old Testament talks about Lebanon, they're actually talking about a forest. They're talking about a tree. Lebanon was known for its trees, for its wood. It was very beautiful wood. The cedars of Lebanon were very beautiful. In fact, they were used for the temple. And so when they talk about Lebanon like that, they're actually talking about a forest and trees. They used wood and constructed for purposes contrary to God's design. They cut it down, and he's probably talking about machines of war and things like that, where God would say, this is not what I meant my creation for. This is not what I meant you to use lumber for, right? They pervert nature. They perverted the relationship between man and animal. You see that in verse 17 as well. And they pervert the sanctity of human life and property. All of this that God has designed, they have distorted. They have used in ways that he did not intend. And for this, the victims are very clear on God's message to them. Right? In the middle of verse 16, the cup from the Lord's right hand is coming around to you. Disgrace will cover your glory. This is a clear statement from them that they are going to receive the full wrath of God. The cup in God's hand is always his wrath, and it will be poured out on them because of their distortion, their perversion of what is natural, of what God designed, used for their own benefit in ways God never intended it to be used. And so they'll receive the full wrath of God and be disgraced. And this is pit in the stomach, terrifying, sad, shocking, and inevitable reality. Even if you don't like those people, witnessing what is coming to them is horrifying. It's horrifying and inevitable. Woe to you because you've perverted everything. Verse 18 says, and now this one will put the declaration of woe right in the middle. For whatever reason, they don't start with the word woe in this one. They put it right in the middle of it. We're meant to be thinking about idols and how useless they are when we get to the woe. Of what value is an idol carved by a craftsman or an image that teaches lies? For the one who makes it trusts in his own creation. He makes an idol that cannot speak. Woe to him who says to wood, come to life, or to a lifeless stone, wake up. Can it give guidance? It's covered with gold and silver. There's no breath in it. So this is the fifth woe. The Babylonians believed that they could control the divine. They could control God and write their own objective truth by creating idols representative of their imagined truth, answerable and manipulatable by men. Right, that's what an idol is. An idol is, this is how I think it works, and if I create something like an idol and a system, I can manipulate it, right? And so if the harvest isn't good enough, I can manipulate that to my favor by creating an idol that represents the God of harvest and then making some sacrifices, and then I can feel confident that I'm in control, no one else, right? It's a way to manipulate the divine, to manage the divine. And create your own imagined truth into something that you're in control of. And so their gods answered to them. They didn't answer to God, the Babylonians. Their gods answered to them. And they elevated their own ideas to the level of God. Right? And this one, if you were to look again at verses 18 and 19, this one doesn't contain a message of punishment. You'll notice that. Woe to you because you've done this, and for this God will. It doesn't contain one of those because it is his own consequence. Creating your own God and worshiping in idolatry, what your imagination has come up with to establish your own truth and then manipulate your own truth in that way for your own benefit is its own consequence. As a result, he says it in verse 19, they receive no guidance. Because you've rejected God and created your own idolatrous truth, your own God, you receive no guidance. You receive no objective truth to help you navigate life. And so they're left to their own idiocy in trusting themselves. That is the consequence of idolatry. You have no objective truth to live your life by. You receive no guidance, and you have the idiocy of trusting something that isn't capable of guiding you through life. That's the horrible consequence of idolatry. Woe to you because you've elevated your imagination to the level of divine. Now let's pause for a moment. Remember, all of this is focused on Babylon. They're pointing fingers at their oppressors, at the Babylonians. And so there's two things that I want us to realize about these five declarations of woe, and then we're going to move on because I want us to leave with, my prayer is, a distinct impression at the end of this. I want us all to be impressed and leave with an impressed feeling, and hopefully we do. But I want us to realize two things first about these five declarations. So this truth from God in a very unique format, one that we're not fully used to reading, regarding is truth, right, from God regarding Babylon. It's directly addressing Habakkuk's complaint. And you remember that the answer for those who trust God is that everything will be resolved in the end. And that should be enough for us. When God told Habakkuk and his audience, the answer is in the end, that should be enough to resolve that for them, to give them a reminder to walk by faith. It should be enough for us. Not easy, but it should be enough. But regarding Habakkuk's complaint and their situation and their answer, trust me, live by faithfulness to faith, wait for the end resolution, that should be enough. But God also, we have a glimpse here, and we know history, he's not ignoring the problem. He's not ignoring the Babylonians' wickedness. And this is for them. And so I want us to realize one important thing that should help us is that verses, sometimes, not every text in the Bible is about you, but every text in the Bible is for you. Right, and so we have to read it in that way, right? Not every text in the Bible is about me, but every text in the Bible is for me. And so verses 6 through 19, through 20, is about the Babylonians, right? It's about them. And so we don't want to necessarily take the woe to him who piles up stolen goods because God's going to make you get your plunder. No, that's for the Babylonians, right? Now, we'll get to this in a second. So you can't take that and say, well, if somebody steals things, somebody's going to get them, and they're going to get theirs stolen because Habakkuk chapter 6, right? Or chapter 2. Right? This is for the Babylonians, right? And not every text is about us, but every text is for us, and we'll get to that part. But I want you to see something not in the text. In 539 BC, not in Habakkuk's lifetime, Cyrus the Great of Persia overthrew the Babylonian Empire, and the oppressors became oppressed. And their society that they had built, and their nest that they had put on high, and the buildings and the homes that they created for their families were completely undone, and their security was stolen. God did not leave the wickedness of Babylon unpunished or unaddressed. And these woe declarations spoken by the future victims were real, were horrible realities because of the Babylonian injustice and wickedness. And Daniel, when you read Daniel chapter 5, Daniel warns Belshazzar of Babylon, of the Babylonian Empire, on the night that Cyrus of Persia's army sneaks under the walls of Babylon, diverts the Euphrates River, and sneaks under the walls. On that night, they're having a dinner, and Daniel warns him. You remember, it's that many Tekel Upharsin writing on the wall, right? And he tells him, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Right? That night, Babylon falls, and every single one of these woes communicated by the victims comes true, becomes a reality. And so I want you to see that these woes are specific. They're not unaddressed. They're not just, oh, you're going to get yours. These are specific realities that came to the Babylonians. This was truth. This was inevitable truth spoken by God. The answer was in the end, but God addressed Babylonians' wickedness true to his message. Habakkuk didn't know this, didn't see this, but he got his answer, and he got his answer in the end. And God did address the Babylonian wickedness. And so, but I want to also address that this is about them, but it's also for us, right? It's also for us. And so even though this section of Habakkuk is directed towards Babylon, we're not the subject, right? We're not the original recipients of that woe to him who builds his house by unjust gain. That's not specifically for us initially, and all the rest of them. Each of these woes, though, reinforce God's character. They each reinforce God's values and his standards and his desires. And so we shouldn't necessarily take specific application from woe to you who steal because it will be stolen from you, because we might get through life and never see that happen, it being stolen from us. That was for the Babylonians, right? But this does reveal God's desires and character, so we should at least take note and think, man, God does not like and deals severely with people who use power for profit, or who find their security at the expense and the hurt of others, or who resort to cruelty in relationships, or who pervert natural things that God designed to be good, or who replace God with their own ideas. God really doesn't like that, and he does deal severely with them. Like, we can take that away from this and take note of that. Even though he's speaking to the Babylonians, we can note certain things from this text for ourselves, things that God doesn't like, very clearly doesn't like. And sometimes we pretend like the Old Testament doesn't really speak to us today, right? Or that God doesn't really speak to us how he feels about certain things. And we can't really know what God actually feels about things. Or we use the New Testament to kind of misunderstand those things and say, well, God is love. Yeah, well, he also said this. He also said some very specific things about how he feels about the way that we interact with his world. And so Habakkuk does speak to today, and it does reveal how God feels. Even though this is for the Babylonians, we can take away that this reveals to us how God feels and his character and his desires and his standards. And so you can add these to your list of things God obviously cares about. You can add these to your list somewhere from Habakkuk chapter 2. God very much cares how we treat each other, very much. And he will deal severely with people who mistreat others. I can't promise you it's going to be in your lifetime, and I can't promise you it's going to be in like manner as he did with the Babylonians, but I can promise you that God cares very much about how we treat others, and he will deal with that severely. I can also tell you that God obviously cares about how we structure our lives and view success, how we build our lives, that we do it well, that we do it right, that we don't do it at the expense of others, that we do it honestly. I can tell you God cares about that because of Habakkuk 2. And when we do it the wrong way, he does notice. And he will deal with that eventually. Maybe not in the same way he does with the Babylonians, but this does reveal the heart of God about how we structure our lives and how we view success. You see it here. And you can add to your list of things that God cares about that he cares about how we interact with his creative designs. The things that he made, the things that he meant for a specific purpose, he cares very much about how we interact with that. That we use things, that we interact with his creation the way that he meant for us to interact with it. And he will deal with people who abuse it, who pervert it. Maybe not in the exact same way as the Babylonians, this was theirs, but you can at least take away from this that he cares a lot about how we interact with his creation and his design. So he cares about these things very much, so much that when we see others disregard, when we see others not treating people the way that God clearly expects, or when we see others building their lives in a way that does not honor God or reflect his values, or when we see others abusing his design in creation and in the created order, or even when we make those abuses, we should have a sinking feeling in our stomachs like we are watching the towers fall. You don't know what you're messing with. You don't know what you're doing. There is so much more here. Like the weight, the sinking shock and terror and horror and inevitability. Right? You are messing with something that you don't realize. God cares very much about this. And he has distinct feeling. And he has addressed this severely in the past. We should recognize this is what God cares about. And it is no small thing to disregard the feelings of God. This was for the Babylonians. It's about them, but it's also for us. That was an aside. That's Habakkuk and that's the Old Testament, but it's not always about us, but it is for us. And we can take those things away from this text. Now, unpause. So the most powerful piece in this text isn't actually the woe lament of the victims. It's not in the message of judgment to the Babylonians. It's in verse 14 that we skipped. It is in this moment of worship and clarity that they give within the terror and the sadness and the shock and the inevitability and the reality of God's judgment and wrath in verse 14. So look at, remember, they have just declared what the Babylonians are doing and what is coming to the Babylonians. They are watching these towers fall. And then they say this in the middle in verse 14, the earth will be filled with the knowledge and the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. They have this unusual moment of clarity in the middle of all this. This verse doesn't fit when you read the rest of them. This is, you pause for a moment, you're like, what just happened? Where did that come from? Like, how is that just pop out there? And within this overwhelming, overstimulating picture of God's judgment and the swirling wind and inevitability of God's wrath, where they're just building up, right, this sense of like, oh, this is not good, this is not good, this is really not good, you don't know what you're doing. We know this is coming, this is all coming, right? And it's building up, and this inevitability of God's outpouring of his character, and the victims suddenly cry out, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. I want to camp here for a minute. So the knowledge of the glory of God, glory of the Lord, you see that's in all caps, it's Yahweh, that's God. It's his most personal name. That knowledge is no small thing, the knowledge of the glory of God. It's not a phrase to be overlooked or taken with this casual, you know, just browsing over it. The glory of Yahweh, the Lord, and we'll start there, the glory of the Lord, the glory of God is the expression of who God is. It is his intangible nature, yet tangibly present. And it pours out of who he is. It's the glory of God. It's the glory of God is the beauty of his character and everything that he is. And it is able to be witnessed and noticed in tons of ways within his creation and within our world and what he has made. Isaiah witnesses God's glory, the expression of who he is, the intangible of him in a tangible way. He witnesses God's glory as so pure that it set things on fire around him in God's throne room. That's in Isaiah 6:3. You can read that if you want to follow up on that. Ezekiel describes God's glory like a rainbow after the rain when he sees it. And again, if you want to follow up on that, it's Ezekiel 1. Moses couldn't even look directly at the beauty of God's character, his presence. And even being on the periphery of his presence made Moses' face glow. But even when we're not directly in God's presence, his character and everything he is expressed to us in abundance. It is poured out in the world. The psalmist says in Psalm 19 that the heavens, that creation expresses the beauty of everything that God is, and so do his deeds. The beauty of who God is and the beauty of what God does is throughout the heavens. The beauty of God's character is tangible. The intangible parts of who God is pour out in tangible ways for us. And it's tangible in his, you can experience it in his daily grace and mercy, giving and withholding. It's the outpouring of this beautiful character. The beauty of his character is in laughter and love. It's in that feeling of accomplishment that you get in doing something well. It's in a satisfying meal. It's in the use of your vision to see, but it's also in the science of corrective lenses, that there was genius in that ability to design. It is the beauty of who God is poured out in so many ways around us. The glory of God is his character and his nature, is things like omniscience and creativity and generosity and authority and ingenuity and consistency and forgiveness expressed, and all of those things expressed and poured out in all the ways that it can be. This is the glory of God. It's everything inside him coming outside of him in all those different ways, right? In all the ways that he shows himself to us. But that's the glory of God, verse 14. But it is the knowledge of God's glory that the victims are acknowledging in their worship despite being oppressed. Knowing in this sense is not knowing of. I know of. This knowledge, this knowing is intimate. It is intuitive. It is personal. Knowledge like this, the knowledge of the glory of God that they're talking about, is not information, it's experience. Right? The knowledge is not just in the brain, but it's in the heart and the gut. You know this. You know it in your bone. You maybe even not be able to say how you know it. You just know. That is what this knowledge is. The glory of God, his expressed character and nature, is something that can be and is to be known, to be experienced on a personal, intimate, gut level, not just in your head, but in your heart. Like when you see cumulonimbus clouds, it's not saying, I know what kind of clouds those are. It's going, wow, look at that. It's a part of who you are, that gut level knowledge, experience. It's a sixth sense, and the whole earth is filled, they say, is topped off and overflowing with an abundance of God's expressed character, the tangibly intangible nature and character of God, and it can be experienced on the deepest, most personal level by every single individual. The earth is, they say, or will be, filled with God's glory. The knowledge, the ability to experience and know God's character, all of the ways that it's expressed on the deepest, most personal level. God's glory covers the earth like water covers the sea, they say at the end of verse 14. It's to be experienced and known and integrated into who you are and how you live. It is everywhere for us to interact with and integrate. And here's what we're seeing from the chorus of these victims who, in the middle of being oppressed, in the middle of feeling this deep lament at what the Babylonians are doing, and also the horror of realizing what's coming to them, which is in a way satisfying, but also sickening, in the middle of it, they worship. And their declaration of woe here, this message of God, speaks of God's judgment and wrath, and those are expressions of God's character. Those are tangible expressions of God's intangible character. It's part of his expressed nature. It's part of his glory. And the victims are observing God's glory expressed. They're seeing it expressed in this judgment. right? In this wrath, this is his justice and his holiness and his discipline, his righteous anger, all being expressed, and they're witnessing it pouring out. And that expression, this is what I want us to see, that expression of God's glory, his justice and his wrath and the pureness of his intentions and his nature that is bringing judgment on the Babylonians, and they're seeing it. This expression of God's glory is drowning the Babylonians, right? Like waters pouring over the earth, the Babylonians are being drowned in the expression of God's character, because part of God's character is justice and wrath and truth. And when you are not living in justice, when you are not living in truth, you will be inundated and experienced. You will have a knowledge of what that is in God's character. It will pour over you. And in the Babylonians' case, it is drowning them. But that same flood of God's nature, of God's being, that's drowning the Babylonians, the victims are being comforted by it. They're celebrating it, right? The earth is, they are so thrilled that the earth will be filled with the ability to experience God's character and his nature like waters covering the sea. And the Babylonians are being drowned in that, but his victims are being comforted by it, comforted by that glory. They're saturated by God's presence, by his expressed character and how his nature is revealed and made tangible to them. And in the middle of this woe declaration, they are worshiping him because of the outpouring of his character that's drowning the Babylonians but comforting them. And while the rest of the world is overcome by the weight of the wave of God's character and his nature, these victims are in awe of it and relieved by it. So here's the picture of what I want you to see. Some of you love water. Some of you don't so much. You didn't learn how to swim. You're not very strong in it. So when we go to Bethany Camp, one of my favorite things to do in the summer when we go as a family to the camp is to get like 2 pool noodles and then go out into the middle of the pond that they have there, the swimming pond, and float and put my head back with my ears just below the surface of the water and stare up at the sky and just float. That. You feel it, right? You can imagine it. Some of you are not swimmers. You don't want to go near the water because you know if you were to go out there in that same place, you would be just drowning, treading water, desperately trying to stay up, right? But that's not why I love it. I love to go float and cut out all the noise and just rest. That's why I love it. And what these victims see as they're saturated by God's glory, as they're buoyed by it, they're floating in it, and their attention, look at verse 20, is drawn to this reality in verse 20. See, they've laid back in the flood of God's character, and they've looked up, and they're floating in it, and they see the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent. They're not treading water. They're not drowning in the character of God because of his judgment and his wrath and his truth. They're floating on it. And then they've got their eyes looked into the heavens, and they see God and the beauty of his character, the beauty of his nature, poured out all around him, all around them. And if you're living faithful to faith, then let yourself be saturated by God's character and all the ways that he expresses himself. Let it drown out the noise around you and look up and see the king is on his throne. See the smile of God and let the silence of the world becalm you, be drowned out by the character of God. Sometimes we literally just need to pause for a minute, just look up. The beauty of God is there to be experienced all around us when everything seems to be out of control and overwhelming. And look up. The king is on his throne. Let all the earth be silent before him. And this is the reality of our lives as expressed by these victims. God's glory can either drown you or it can saturate and relieve you. It is all around us. And it can either overwhelm you and drown you, or it can saturate you and relieve you. You can push against his character. You can reject his nature and experience only the harsh expressions of it. Or you can learn to be saturated and relieved by it, covered up to your face in it and buoyed by it and enjoy it. Now, this is critical. One more piece to add. The victims that Habakkuk hears say that the earth, verse 14, will be filled. Obviously, the knowledge of God's glory already has filled the earth. In Habakkuk's day, the expression of his character is everywhere. But they are also pointing towards something amazing. In the New Testament, the beauty of God's character and everything that God is, the expression of his nature was revealed fully in Jesus. John chapter 1, verse 14 and verse 18, John tells us that Jesus became flesh and made his dwelling among us, and we've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known, has revealed the glory of God. Hebrews, the author of Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3, the Son is the radiance of God's glory. He's the exact representation of God's being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. Jesus is now, for us, the full expression of the intangible God. Everything about God's character and nature was expressed to us in Christ. And through Jesus and his ministry of salvation, his representation of God's character, the earth has been filled, topped off. If it was already full, we just started pouring until it was overflowing in Christ, with the personal, complete experience of God's character in Jesus. And in Jesus, God reveals his truth, his justice, his holiness, his love, his mercy, his grace to each of us, to all of us. And in a personal relationship with Jesus, we fully experience and we intuit the beauty of God's character and everything that he is. When we know Jesus, when we experience Christ, we experience everything that is beautiful about God. We know what is beautiful about God. Not knowing the information about Jesus, but intuitively on a heart and gut level, deep in our bones, knowing Jesus, knowing, experiencing his forgiveness, experiencing his grace, experiencing truth, being saturated by Jesus, who was full of grace and truth. And the reality is, if you do not know God in this way, if you don't know the beauty of God through Jesus, then you invite his judgment and wrath. You will experience his character. You will know the wrathful side of God. The weight of God's glory through Jesus will crash on top of you and drown you. Woe to you. And the victims in this passage saw the weight of God's glory filling and saw the world experiencing his nature, but instead of drowning, they were saturated and relieved by the glory of God. They were buoyed and comforted by it. And it is good, it is important to saturate yourself in God's glory, ultimately expressed in Jesus. And in the midst of life, within the overwhelming, overstimulating, swirling wind and inevitability of life, remember that the same character of God that brings judgment on all that you hate and all that he hates also expressed itself in your forgiveness and your salvation through his Son. And so instead of drowning, you could float and be calmed. You can rest. And so stop in the chaos. Stop in the concern. Lean all the way back. Let go for a minute. Quiet your mind and be saturated and relieved. Silence the noise. Look at the expression of God's nature around you and beyond, and see the King in his holy temple, and beside him your Savior Jesus. The radiance of God's character and his nature. Because of him, despite everything around you, you can experience the full beauty of everything that God is. Close your eyes for a minute. Lean back. God, I love you. Sometimes we just need you to calm us and draw our attention to who you are and everywhere you are around us. So for my brothers and sisters who need a moment of calm, will you overwhelm them and saturate them with the weight of your glory? Silence their world and draw their eyes to you. For all of us, help us to remember to take those moments to pause. I pray this in your name.